It's just recording.
Okay. Welcome back.
Nailed it.
Welcome back to Technically Economics. This is episode 2. I am Dominic.
I'm Cassidy.
And we are two PhD students in economics at Harvard. Like I said, this is our second episode. We were super excited by all of the feedback on the first episode. So many different friends, family, strangers telling us things that they liked about the show, didn't like about the show. And so we're going to incorporate all the feedback. We really appreciate it. We're going to get better.
I don't know if we're going to incorporate all the feedback.
Yeah, that's right. We'll incorporate.
That's ambitious.
Yeah. We'll incorporate some of the feedback. We're going to get better. We're going to get stronger as a show. And we're super excited that to have this growing listener base. I think I was actually pretty surprised, pleasantly surprised by that.
Yeah. We were so excited to see how many of you guys tuned in to listen. So thank you. Thank you so much.
Yeah. And you can follow us on Instagram now. We have Instagram at Technically Economics. Cassidy, can you remind us the premise of this show?
Yes. So if you missed our first episode, on each episode of this podcast, either Dominic or I is going to bring a topic of discussion and try to convince the other one that that topic technically counts as economics.
I went first last week to talk about Love Island. And Dominic, I have an update.
Okay.
I don't know if this came through in our conversation, but I'm like a pretty big Love Island fan.
Okay, yes. That did come through, yeah.
Okay. Well, as you know, last night I went to the Red Sox game with my parents who are in town visiting. And who comes out to throw the first pitch at the Red Sox game? None other than Amaya Papaya and Brian, and it was amazing.
Wow.
It was amazing.
I don't remember the names of anyone on Long Island, but I'm going to assume those are two people from
they were
Love
the
Island
winners.
From the way you said.
Okay. They were the winners of this current season of Love Island.
Nice.
But that's not where it ends, Dominic.
Yeah.
Because I'm in my seat. I'm freaking out about Love Island. I'm being loud. I'm like sharing photos with the people around me.
Okay.
And the woman next to me goes, "Are you a Love Island fan?"
Okay.
And I said, yes. And she says, "I'm a reporter for the Boston Globe."
Oh, no.
"And I'm doing a feature on them being at this game tonight. Can I interview you about Love Island?" Dominic, would you like to see this Boston Globe article?
I would very much like to see this Boston Globe article, yes.
Why don't you read this section aloud for the people?
Okay. Let me move my microphone. Cassidy Schubot, a Harvard doctoral student clad in a backward cap, said she studies economics, and her next podcast episode, will explore the economics of the show. She was at the game with her fiance and parents, who were visiting from Dubuque, Iowa. Wow.
I'm famous, Dominic.
That is in the Boston Globe. Yeah.
That is in the Boston Globe. Look it up.
Okay, so Dominic, what are we talking about today?
I'm a little nervous for this because you did the first one and tried to convince me. So this is my first time trying to convince you.
Yes, and I'm a tough audience, and you know that.
So I put together a lot of different things, and I'm excited.
Okay.
Today, I'm going to try to convince you that there's a lot of economics in group chats.
Ooh,
yeah, the little conversations that you have with many of your friends all at once.
Okay, let's go.
Sounds like you're in group chats.
I'm in group chats.
Can you talk to me a little bit about your experience in group chats, the different sorts of group chats that you're in?
Yes, I can. So I'm in a few group chats. We're in a group chat together. We have a group chat with all of our classmates.
Oh, that's true.
We have
a
cohort group chat.
I guess this includes both iMessage, because that's a messenger group chat.
That's a messenger group chat.
But I guess that's...
That should count,
that definitely counts. You're right.
I have a group chat with my three closest friends. We've been friends since we were like freshmen in high school.
Nice.
The group chat is called Wordle because there was a period in, 2021 where we just sent our Wordles every day.
And you didn't update the name.
And we have never updated the name, and I doubt any of us has done a Wordle in, like, several years. I have a group chat with my siblings that's almost exclusively me sending, like, updates about what I'm up to in hopes that my siblings will reciprocate. But unfortunately, this rarely happens. And
Go ahead.
No. I was just going to say, I have a series of family group chats, and then for when we're buying a gift for one person for their birthday, we have, like, iterations of the group chat where it's everyone except that one person, and then you text it again, like, a year later, and it's like, oh, this is what we got last year. Yeah. That's a good reminder.
Yeah, so I have one that's me and my three younger siblings, and then I have another one that's my siblings and I and my dad. And okay. If I'm the main one sending things in the siblings group chat, it's mostly my dad sending, like, childhood photos of himself and his siblings, or, like, photos of my grandparents, and then, like, occasionally he gets, like, a, wow, cool.
Yeah, like, the pity, like, or something. I do, like, my parents also recently retired, and I feel like the number of group chat messages have gone up quite a bit, yeah.
I love them. Dad, if you're listening, love the messages.
True. But it's actually, like, I haven't really, like, thought through whatever the third wall of this podcast before of, like, people listening, and so I'm gonna continue to pretend that no one is listening and we're just chatting. I think anything else would stress me out way too much. It's interesting, there's, like, been a lot of discussion about the explosion of social media and whether it's good or bad, but bad. I think there's less, we've also had this sort of explosion of group chats, at least in my life, and I think they're super pervasive, and I think we don't think about that as much, about whether it's sort of good or bad, and maybe that's because they're sort of mostly good, but I'm not at all sure. I'd be curious what you think.
Yeah. I kind of had this thought today as well, like, thinking about this podcast and not sure what you were going to say, and I feel like I am consuming so much media about how social media is destroying us and, like, rotting our brains, and, like, constant access to one another is, like, bad in important ways, and I would say I'm pretty susceptible to that kind of argument. But then thinking about this, I was exactly trying to think about, well, how much of these things apply to, like, a group chat? What about, like, a Snapchat group? That's a very, and I don't know, that feels hard to think about to me.
When I was thinking about that, there's less of the, like, everyone's life seems perfect, because I feel like the group chat is, like, a little bit more used every day, you know, with closer friends and things. So you see those sort of imperfection of life. But it does have that same, like, taking you out of the present kind of thing. And, like, Snapchat's super aggressive with the notifications in ways that are, like, you know, reminiscent of some of the other bad parts of social media. I don't know.
Yeah, and, like, when you have a group chat that you are trying to chill out for a couple hours or get some work done for a couple hours, and then you come back to, like, 117 messages. That is not a feeling that inspires calm in me.
No, exactly. Yeah. So I don't know. It's interesting that we never think about it as social media. When, like, again, in my life, I think group chats has a much bigger impact on a lot of the different decisions that I make.
Yes. Yep. I totally agree. I'm not a huge social media user, but I just, that's just, like, when I'm trying to avoid work, I just, like, I'm tip-tapping all kinds of messages to my little buddies.
Exactly.
Maybe there's something that's a little better about that, but I don't know.
Yeah. And so this is good. We're going to use these answers that you've had against you as we go through this.
Oh,
not
no.
immediately, but it'll come back.
Okay.
And so I think my plan to convince you that group chats, there's a lot of technically economics in group chats, I'm going to do three different angles.
Oh, three?
Yeah.
I only did
one. Well, okay. They're all going to be, I think,
a one-upper,
you have
one
strong angle. I'm going to have three sort of weak, no, I'm selling myself.
Yeah,
three pretty
yourself.
Strong angles, but three sort of shorter angles.
Okay.
Because I think there's many different interesting pieces of economics in group chats.
Okay, I'm ready.
Okay, so I'm going to dive into the first of the three. And to do that, I want to start by asking you another question.
Another question.
Which is, have you been in any group chats with so you have an iPhone?
I have an iPhone.
Have you been in any group chats with non-iPhone users?
Yes, I am engaged to a non-iPhone user, turn out.
Oh, no.
Yes. My fiancé, Scott, does not have an iPhone. And we, to be honest, I'm in a lot of group chats. Have historically been a lot of group chats that it would make sense for Scott to be in, but he's simply in them because he doesn't have an iPhone.
Because of the bubble,
But it does, it has like gotten less annoying, right? Like it used to be that it was extremely annoying to have a non-iPhone user. And then I believe a law happened.
Oh, we'll talk about it. We'll talk about it.
I don't know exactly what happened. I just know that from my perspective, it did get less annoying.
Yes. Yes.
I also have, like, my mom also has never had an iPhone. And as I mentioned before, our family group chat is my siblings and my dad.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. My older brother is another iPhone, like a proud iPhone holdout.
Yeah.
And I mean, he's in all the group chats, but I'm just annoyed. But less annoyed recently. You're right. There's been some changes. So we'll talk about that. And I actually had you read for this episode a recent working paper, and I want to talk about that now.
Okay. Because yes. I think we saw this paper presented together as well.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, yeah. This person came and presented at Harvard, so we saw the presentation together.
Okay.
It is called Non-User Utility and Market Power, The Case of Smartphones.
Wow, yeah. So exciting.
And so I guess I don't know if we're going to do show notes, but we'll link it in the show notes. And so I want to... In your episode, you sort of took us back to the first year of economics and embarrassed me with how little I knew. And I think this paper takes us back to even like the first day of first year economics. It's the sort of basic idea in economics that people do things to maximize utility, which is like some rough notion of satisfaction given scarce resources.
Uh-huh.
And I think the fundamental point of this paper is that it says, you know, we usually think of getting utility or satisfaction from like consuming products, like, I don't know, eating more carrots in first year econ. but you also might have products that lower your utility if you don't buy it.
Yes, okay.
And so I think that's a super interesting point in this paper. And so now I want to ask you a question. And here I have a little inside information from your friends.
My friends?
Why do you own an iPhone? Sorry, I know the answer to this, so you have to answer truthfully.
Oh, no. Okay, well, so I respect people who don't have iPhones.
Yeah. You're engaged to one, yeah.
I'm engaged to one. I respect them. And I don't know how much you know this about me. I'm, like, kind of a, like, paranoid person.
Yeah.
Tech user.
Yeah. I knew this, and this is what our mutual friend. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So I like don't. I'm weird about talking to ChatGPT, and if I do talk to it, then I also like to say things to confuse it.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
And so I am kind of fundamentally averse to the fact that I have like a MacBook and an Apple Watch and an iPhone. Like, I don't like that they have me in their ecosystem.
Yeah.
And in the fall, I was kind of on like a digital security privacy kick,
and I was
really talking a big game. I also badly needed a new phone. My phone was broken. I was talking a big game to everyone, like, and I'm going to not get an iPhone
yes,
this
yes,
time.
This is what I didn't hear this rant, but our mutual friend heard this,
It's like, I'm going to get out of here. I don't want one company having all of my data and seeing how I use my technology. At the minimum, I want to be spreading out my interactions. And then one day I got an email from Verizon, my provider, that they were doing like a trade-in deal on the iPhone, on the new iPhone, and I just immediately clicked it, ordered it, and like had the new phone in my hand the next day. And my friend, our friend of the pod, Coley.
Yeah, I'll go. I never identified our mutual friend.
I know it's Coley.
Yeah.
Coley asked me, "Oh, haven't you been talking about planning to get a non-iPhone?" And I'd fully forgotten. It didn't even cross my mind when the email came. I just thought, "Oh, great. It's time to upgrade. Here's my new iPhone." I didn't even think about it.
Yeah.
So now I'm still in the ecosystem at least 3 more years.
Yeah. I do think we have another mutual friend that I think on the GPT knowing too much is something that I never thought of. You have always been like the...
Yes, I'm very fearful of ChatGPT.
Yeah. And he has just created identities. He'll be like, "My friend Henning likes these things. What would you recommend for my friend?" And then just like make up other identities that are not his true preferences just to throw it off. So I don't know. I feel like that's maybe a strategy. But would you say that the color of the bubbles played some role in your decision to buy a phone?
To be honest, I think for me, it is not about the color of the bubbles.
Oh, okay.
What's definitely true is I want my things to play nice together.
Yeah.
And whether that's like play nice with other phones, which I think is like what Green Bubble is kind of about, versus like play nice just with my other devices. Same two sides of the same coin, I guess.
Yeah. No, that makes sense. And I want to get back to the green versus blue bubbles, because I know it does sound sort of like cute or whatever, but I think, I don't know if this was the paper that actually goes into this or just the talk that we saw. Like, I think there is this super sort of sad and compelling story around, you know, kids being bullied for like having the green bubbles, because it's such, you know, it's so related to like socioeconomic status. And so if your you know, family can't afford to get you an iPhone, and then there's this sort of reason that like now you have the green bubble, it's like super obvious. It also you know, lowers the quality of photos if you're sharing photos. Okay, so I think that's some, you know, in economics we talk about the supply and demand side. So I think there's a lot of different reasons on the demand side, or a lot of different interesting economics on the demand side.
Yep.
But I think as we were sort of getting to at the end there, there's also some interesting economics on the supply side. So, you know, if you, I'll ask you a question, if you were a firm and you know that this sort of disutility thing exists, you know, how would you sort of design products in light of that?
Yeah, so I guess if you know this disutility is there, then you want to make that like, that's what's keeping people from leaving your ecosystem.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
You want to make it really obvious to people that if you leave, it's going to be more annoying.
Yeah, exactly. And there's other examples of this in the paper where I thought one that was like funny but also kind of bad is, so Google allegedly made YouTube load slower on rival browsers to get you to use Google Chrome. And so there's sort of other examples of firms doing that, which I think brings us back to these group chats and what I was saying before. You know, from my reading, it doesn't seem to be a technological problem. There's no reason they couldn't make iMessage available on Android. And instead, it seems like they're intentionally doing things like, you know, making the photos low quality, making the likes super annoying. And as we talked about at the beginning, this has changed recently. There was a Department of Justice antitrust investigation actually into this. And some emails that came out of that where execs were basically saying exactly what we're saying, which is like, I have one written down where someone said, you know, moving iMessage to Android will hurt us more than help us, when it was like they were talking about it.
It's kind of interesting that I feel like I heard iPhone users complain about the green bubbles like much more so than Android users. And anytime I, as an iPhone user, was complaining to one of these like really proud Android users, they're like, it's not Android, it's Apple that's not doing the thing. But I feel like most the sort of the canonical average position is to be like annoyed at Android or feel that it's
a feature of
Android, when obviously it was just Apple the whole time.
Yeah, and that is part of the sort of
dun, dun, dun.
Well, the in the paper itself, part of the like how they're trying to prove to you that it's disutility and not something else is exactly this point that it's like a majority of both Android users and iPhone users who say that the green bubble didn't exist. So it's not like you know maybe like an expensive product or something that creates envy in other people or something like that. It's really like even the people who use the product itself are annoyed by this thing, which I think is interesting.
Yeah, it is interesting.
But just to sort of conclude the first of my angles.
Okay.
So we had both demand, supply side. I feel like
two of the big ones.
Two of the big ones. If there's a platform, maybe there's more, but not in this case. So I think there's a lot of economics in there. And then the conclusion of the story, which you mentioned, and so the DOJ starts to investigate, and it actually wasn't a law. It was like allegedly, I mean, Apple hasn't said we're doing this because DOJ is investigating us, but it was, there's this antitrust thing. We're trying to take some allegedly trying to take some heat off the antitrust thing. And so they switched over to this like RCS messaging thing instead of SMS that makes things play a little bit more nicely.
Okay. Wow. Regulatory bodies, so powerful how they don't even have to do the actual
thing.
If you just think they will, enough.
That's right. Yeah. The threat of enforcement is can be regulation, I guess. Okay, so I'm going to move on from this first angle. Any final thoughts on blue and green bubbles, lockout, antitrust?
Free the people. I don't know.
Fair enough, Okay. All right. To transition to the next piece of economics and group chats. So this is two of three.
Okay.
I want to do that again by asking you a question.
Okay.
What do you think the optimal size of a group chat is?
This totally depends. I was thinking about this a lot. Like, a group chat is a place of trust. And I yes. think it is possible to have a good group chat of many sizes if the people in that chat have a shared understanding
oh,
of
yeah.
what kinds of things the chat should yeah. be used for.
Yeah, no, I agree with that.
However, it's very hard to find that shared understanding. And so yeah. I feel that in practice, most group chats above like 5 people, I'm yeah. usually finding to be, I'm finding to be a bit much.
Okay, yeah. I feel like it also depends on the context too. Because I feel like there's two kind of types of group chats. Maybe this is not nearly so neat in the world, but like there's the, we're planning something, it's the bachelor party group chat.
Yes.
And they're like, you know, maybe you're more constrained because you're just like, you got to have the people in the bachelor party. And then there's the like living forever group chat.
Yes. Exactly right.
And I guess that you're right that it like hinges on not only, this is not the economics point I want to make, but not only the like average ability to follow norms in the group chat. It's really like the most annoying. If the most yeah. annoying person is annoying,
yes.
then a 20-person group chat does not work. Like,
yeah, and I really live my life trying not to be the most annoying.
Yeah, yeah, in the group chat.
I
yeah.
try to be 75th percentile annoying at worst.
Do you think that's one of those things where it's like, if you don't know the most annoying person in the group chat, you might be the most annoying person in the group chat?
I think that's right. I think if you look through the chat and you notice that you're sending like well above your share,
yeah.
you gotta wonder.
Yeah, I guess that's fair. But then, like, I mean, maybe the answer is you are the annoying one. But do you think you're the annoying one in the group chat with your siblings?
Yeah.
Okay. Fair enough. Yeah.
Yeah. But see, what I'm hoping is, I think they're all younger than me, and I feel like they think I'm like a little cringe. But
okay.
I hope
yeah,
that
yeah.
I'm modeling to them that it's okay to be cringe if it's keeping you in touch with your loved ones.
Yeah.
And then maybe one day they'll start sending photos back of what they're up to in their lives.
Yes. Something to hope for. So now I'm going to ask you what maybe seems like a non sequitur.
Okay.
But I am going to try to tie it together, I swear. Do you remember anything about Ronald Coase?
Okay. I know there's a Coase theorem.
Yes.
And I think it's about property rights.
That is right.
And that's all I got.
Okay. We are not going to talk about Coase theorem, but that is okay. the same Ronald Coase.
Okay.
We're going to talk about a much earlier work of his. A work he actually did in undergraduate, I learned when I was doing research.
Man, I wish I did something cool in undergrad.
yeah. There's a very funny, like, on the Wikipedia page for this work, which is called The Nature of the Firm, there's, like, he wins a Nobel Prize in part for, you know, property rights, in part for The Nature of the Firm and his other work. And so it talks about this on his Wikipedia page, and he's, like, annoyed by it because he's like, this was, like, some, like, dumb undergraduate essay I wrote. And, like,
hell yeah.
But it helped found, like, all of organizational economics, which is like a branch of economics that neither of us are really in.
Yeah,
so this is going to be
we'll
opine
about it anyway.
Exactly. Yeah. We're going to say dumb things, but that's okay. Okay, so The Nature of the Firm, it asks in part like a very simple question, which is like, why do firms exist? And more relevantly for us, it says, what determines the optimal size of a firm?
Oh.
And so I think that's going to be quite related to the optimal size in the group chat.
Is a group chat a firm,
is a
Dominic?
Group chat? I'm
going to
kind of argue it is in a sense. Okay, so,
okay.
You know, as is always the case in economics, the answer to the optimal size of the firm is when the benefit of adding one additional person is equal to the cost of adding one additional person. So
okay.
a bunch of what, you know, what makes this sort of lasting and what made this work special is that he thought through what these actual marginal benefits and marginal costs of. So, like, the marginal benefits are, you know, you don't have to pay the transaction costs of, like, acquiring things outside of the firm. Maybe
okay.
there's search costs and things like that.
Yep.
The marginal cost of adding a person is that, like, more people are harder to manage.
Uh-huh.
And so now to tie it back to group chats and maybe stretching things a little. I think this is kind of the same logic we should think about when we're thinking about teams, more obviously, like optimal size of teams.
Yeah.
But then also the optimal size of group chats. You should think about the sort of marginal benefit and marginal cost of adding one person. So the benefit, as you know, is you get more diverse input, more skills. Maybe you get, you know, more dank memes if you're sharing memes, things
maybe
like that. And the marginal cost is, you know, as we talked about, you start getting, you know, information overload. It's harder to follow conversations.
Yes.
And I think the key here is, as I mentioned before, it's really not the average person in the group chat that matters. It's the sort of marginal person. And that's the same sort of idea that Coase brought in his not Coase's theorem, but in his Nature of the Firm in 1937.
Okay.
What do you think of this so far? I have one last way to try to tie it together.
I'm just trying to think about whether I'm marginal in my group chats.
Yeah.
I definitely have some group chats where I know I'm kind of like
the last one in.
Like if you were to draw sort of like the inner circle, the medium circle, the outer circle, I'm like, I'm on that outer circle for sure. But then in those chats, I guess I feel I just don't say much.
Yeah.
And so I don't know whether the others perceive this as like a cost to me being there.
Yeah.
Or if they're happy to just have me lurk and throw them a like on a good message.
Just give them a little of that like dopamine every now and then. I was going to ask that is like, what is the strategy when you're the marginal person? Is it, you're saying it's blend in, not try to like really prove you belong to be there.
I think it's blend in unless you have something really funny to say.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
then you can be funny.
Yeah.
But you just, it's a constant, you got to be really, really thinking about it. I think, you know, the more people in the chat, the higher your bar should be to post something.
No, okay. And then I think the last piece of economics or way I want to sort of tie, or
okay.
this is still topic two, still Coase.
Oh, still Coase.
Still Coase. But
oh,
I think the okay. last thing I want to say on this is so that I did a little reading of the Nature of the Firm, which is hard to read. It was written in 1937.
Oh,
but
look who's a
no.
Economist.
No. I did a little reading and then
the
I did a little
of the
like
firm.
Well, I did a little reading and then I did a little like I'm gonna take a couple paragraphs and like ask ChatGPT like what did this say? What does this mean? But you know, one other thing the paper does is it talks about what shapes the marginal benefits and marginal costs themselves.
Yeah.
And so I think that's also pretty interesting is like one thing it talks about is like the ability of the manager matters a lot. So like when you – I think that matters here too. So like when you have a bachelor, bachelorette party planning group chat and you know you have maybe the inner circle that's planning activities.
Yes.
I think if the person sort of running it is like organized, then I think it can – you know, you can have more people and it works effectively. But if it's like – you know, me, then it's just chaos and then it doesn't really work. So I think that those sorts of like, you know, I don't want to say, I'm going to say comparative statics, which I hate myself for saying, but those kind of things I think play here too. I think the sort of like, there are other things that determine the optimal size of the group chat beyond the sort of like things that change the marginal benefits and marginal costs,
yes,
I guess.
Yes. I think the purpose of the group chat feels like it changes what the right size.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, I think that's right. Are you going to now view your group chat decision through the lens of Coase's Nature of the Firm?
Here's, I guess, another thing that's weird to think about there is, like, it makes you think about a certain type of, like, intentionality in setting out what should the group chat be.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of group chats that people are in, there wasn't that much intentionality in the group chat being laid out. Like, I think there are some group chats that were started 5 years ago that I'm in, and if they had just been made on a different day, I might not have been in the group chat, but I am,
and now
it's just it's 5 years late. And so it's like, was that optimal? Was that not optimal? Certainly the person making the group chat didn't think that through, but maybe they should have.
Yeah, that is like another thing. Just kind of, I don't know how to feel about it with the whole premise of this podcast, but like I feel like if you start over econ thinking your everyday life, you just like turn into, like I think we were talking about there's like a small literature in economics that asks like, why do people talk to each other like small talk if they don't learn anything from it? I feel like you start like over econing things or just like become an insane person.
Yeah. Yeah, and we're well on our way.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, this podcast is evidence of that. So, yeah, that is true. And I came into like PhD, I was like
more normal,
more like is econ good or bad? And I was just like, I don't know what it is.
I don't know. It's everywhere, man.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
What am I going to do about it?
Yeah.
Okay, so now that was angle two of three.
Okay.
Now we're going to get to angle three.
Let's go.
And to start that, I did have you read one more short popular press article on the collapse of Silicon Valley Bank.
Yes.
Can you talk to me about what you learned from that article?
Yes. So Silicon Valley Bank, SVB, not to be confused with SBF.
Just both crazy finance things.
Both important crazy finance things that were not really happening in my main circles, but kind of broke into my feeds.
Yeah, I will say this, for angle three, I've gone, which I think is fair because matching is much more your domain than mine. I've gone squarely into my domain.
Yes. Okay, so Silicon Valley Bank is a bank that I think a lot of tech companies had huge amounts of money invested in.
Yes.
And there was a run on Silicon Valley Bank a couple of years ago, which bank runs were, I know bank runs were very, very common like 100 years ago.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a Wonderful Life. Is that a bank run?
Yeah. That's, exactly.
And a bank run is when, like, the way banks work is that, you know, people put their money in the banks, but then banks, in order to earn you some return on investment or to spur economic growth, they lend that money out to people who want loans.
Yeah.
And so anyone can get their money out at any time, but it doesn't work if everyone wants their money out at the same time.
Yeah.
And the problem with bank runs is that if you hear that a bunch of other people are taking their money out, then you want to get your money out too.
Yeah.
And I know in the U.S., the way we kind of stopped having bank runs all the time.
Oh, man, you're crushing it.
Can I go? I'm feeling good.
This is,
The reason we don't really have bank runs anymore is that we have the federal government insures up to like $100,000 or something.
I think it's $250,000 now.
Okay, $250,000.
But we'll talk about whether there's a bigger implicit guarantee.
Okay. And so, like, if most people have less than that in the bank, then for kind of, like, everyday people, that's sort of, like, fine. As long as your $250,000 is, like, guaranteed by the government, then even if other people are pulling money out, you don't need to pull your money. So you don't have this kind of, like, unraveling effect. But with tech companies, I assume they have more money.
Yes, that's going to be a key part
of SVB.
So that
seems important. Yeah. But then in the article you sent me, they were describing how there are these like group chats of tech CEOs and like big people in the tech world, like kind of quasi-professional, quasi-personal group chats.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, people just start like posting in this group chat, like "Get your money out! Out of Silicon Valley Bank!" And people just kind of panicked. And if enough people are saying that, then it's like, well, it sort of doesn't matter how real this is. If other people like think it's real, then you have to treat it real too.
Yeah.
And so then everyone pulls the money out. SVB fails.
Yes.
SBF also fails.
In jail. And then just to tie the loose end, which is not going to be, we're going to talk about the group chats piece of it and how that relates to things. But then in finance right now, there's sort of this interesting thing where what happens is, you know, all these people have way more than $250,000 in SVB, and the federal government comes in and says, all right, we're going to save the bank anyway. And so, you know, we've always said we're only going to insure $250,000 of deposits, but, you know, implicitly, are they willing to insure basically anything?
And why does the federal government want to do that? Can you say more about that?
Why?
Like, if the bank already failed, then what's the government doing and why?
Yeah, I mean, I think they're just trying to, you know, calm. There was some worry that there was going to be contagion to other banks. People were going to, so they're trying to sort of calm that storm and just make everyone whole. I think the concern, and why they only do $250,000 and they don't do, like, you know, we'll guarantee everything forever, is classic moral hazard, which is, you know, if you tell the banks that you're always going to bail them out, then they're just going to do whatever, do risky things. And
which I feel like was really, like, the
common man's plea after the 2008 financial crisis and like about like the Bernie Sanders campaign of like we got to stop bailing out.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah,
it's a slightly
yeah.
different setting, yeah, but
much less sympathetic. Like I feel like there it was like investment banks, very non-sympathetic. Yeah. You know, here it's like maybe you're not that sympathetic to these like startups, but they are like pitching themselves as like, oh look, I'm a small business owner. And so yeah, but so there's this kind of. Which we won't talk more about, but there's kind of this question in like academic finance right now about like, okay, well, if there is an implicit guarantee for every bank, is that going to create really bad moral hazard problems?
Yeah.
How do we think about that? Should we not have this implicit guarantee?
And so you're saying there's a moral hazard problem because the bank will want to make banks operate by making loans.
Yeah.
And they have discretion over what types of loans they make. And if they're going to be backed up, then you would worry that the banks would just make, like, crazy loans.
Yeah, yeah. And it's a little bit... SVB was technically, like, a mixture of, like, loans and long-term bond stuff. So it's, like, there's some duration stuff, not just loans. But, yes, you're doing, like, risky things with the money that people give you, I think.
Okay.
So that was great. And this is going to... You've sort of said a lot of the economics that I wanted to get to. But I want to ask you, does the names Diamond and Dibvig mean anything to you? Because you've kind of said a lot of the logic of it. But.
Diamond and Dibvig won a Nobel Prize.
Won a Nobel Prize in 2022.
I know that, and I know it's about banks.
And it's about banks.
And,
it's...
and I usually, yeah, it's about as far as I go on them.
Yeah, nice, nice, yeah. Yeah, and their model lays out a lot of the logic that you just told to me. You know, you're a bank, you're making long-term loans, but consumers, you can want their deposit at any time, so they have this short-term call on you.
Okay, yep.
And then they do like a little simple game theory Nash equilibrium thing, where it's like, look, it's actually optimal to run on the bank if you know that everyone else is going to run on the bank. Because they have these like long-term, like basically you're giving money to a like a food truck to like buy a second food truck.
Yes.
And so even if that's like not risky in short duration, they can't just like liquidate that second food truck and give you, you know, return on the loan. And so there's always this sort of duration risk.
Yeah. Okay, wait. So I have a question. So if a bank is... You know, I understand that a bank could, like, have made loans or something and have all this money out there that, like, if you want it right now today, you can't get it.
Yeah.
But it's not like that loan disappears, right? Like, is someone paying that loan back later? And is there just, like, a time problem? Or, like, what's happening with those sort of outstanding loans or something that SVB had now that it is run out?
Yeah, yeah. So I guess I was getting at this earlier. The SVB example was... a little bit different than like the example I gave, and that what they were doing, you know, they were doing some making loans, but a lot of what they were doing was taking these deposits from these different like startups and things and just parking them in long-term treasuries.
So it
seems like very safe. They're in like these long-term treasuries. You get, you know, nice yields and these whatever. But then interest rates started going up in whatever 2022, 2023.
Okay.
And so the market value... basically because they were getting like, you know, interest rates at this lower rate from like 2021. So the market value of these bonds went down. That actually created a lot of the SVB problem.
I see. So there was like a real change, like loss of value, but it wouldn't have necessarily been a problem had people not run on the bank.
I think that's right. I think that's right. I'm not the 100% SVB expert. Read some articles at the time.
That's okay.
Yeah, that's my understanding of the situation.
Okay, but how's this about group chats again?
Okay, yes. So the article I sent you talks about, as you mentioned, these group chats where these different like startup tech people were all talking to each other. And so I think this sort of like information dissemination is super relevant in this banking. Like, so group chats like make it easier to chat with people quickly, to just change information. That matters in the banking setting. I think more broadly it matters in a lot of finance settings, and even more broadly in like how we make decisions about you know, products and different things. So if you think about, you know, things you've bought or like TV shows you watched or other important decisions you've made, would you say that group chats have influenced those?
Yeah, definitely. And like, I think that group chats are often a place I explicitly go for recommendations and stuff because I like to know what my friends are watching, doing, reading.
Yeah. Oh,
partly because I like value their taste, but also partly because part of the reason I consume things is to like talk about them with
people. Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, that's right. Yeah, so I think in finance, there's a lot of examples of this. And again, I'm just like over-indexing on you know, the corner of economics that I do. But because you have these sort of like really important decisions, like you were saying, that are like pretty complicated. Like it's not, you know, I think it's hard for me. I'm only going to get a mortgage maybe one day I'll get a mortgage. I don't know. Maybe never. But like I'm only going to do it, you know, a few times in my life. And so I'm not very good at that. I don't have opportunities to learn. So it's super important for me to sort of talk to people and and do
that. The thing this makes me think of, and honestly, this could be a different episode we talk about one day, but wedding planning. You have to make so many decisions.
Yeah.
And all my friends have been married before, and so I am reaching out to those resources on like every question, because it's so many types of decisions that you have to make one time and only one time.
Yeah. And I think there's like, you know, that it's all of this is not entirely new. Like people always communicated to make decisions, but the sort of scale at which you're able to do that, I think group chats really affect. And so some of this is, you know, maybe good. You learn about things for your wedding, but then I think what's interesting is like, you know, some of it maybe bad. You know, you have the sort of bank run stuff that comes out of it. You can imagine like there's a lot of work in economics about like social contagion. And so like bubbles that start because people are talking about these different things. And, you know, maybe we get into this in a future pod episode, but there's those like pump and dump schemes, which I know that we've talked about, where it's like a Discord channel where it's like, we're all going to buy this stock or this a meme coin and we're going to do that. And so all those things I think are made possible by this sort of group chat technology, if you think of Discord as like a form of a form of group chat. And so I think that's very economics-y. I don't know.
That is pretty economics,
Yeah. Okay. So just to sum up my three different angles before I ask you the key question of the pod. Angle one, the blue bubble versus green bubble, disutility, firm market power, antitrust. We did both supply and demand, both of the key corners of economics.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Two, we talked about the optimal group chat size. I elegantly related that to Coase's theory of the firm. So I mean, that seems pretty economics-y to me.
Yep.
And then we talked about, at the end, third, we talked about information dissemination, how these group chats affect different economic decisions, especially in financial settings. So given all three of those very economics-y angles, I'll ask you, Cassidy, how economics do you think group chats are?
Okay. So I'm wondering here, like, I'm not saying I would give a low score.
Okay.
But it would feel very mean at any point to be like, like giving a low score in this format does feel like being like, I think you did a bad job.
Yeah. I opened the nature of the firm and had ChatGPT read it to me. Like.
So, here's the things that I'm thinking about. I think like all the things you've told me are definitely very interesting, are definitely economics, and are not things that I thought about as being like parts of like group chat. Like before you told me anything, none of these things came to mind.
Okay.
So I'm very impressed with that. I think what I'm trying to think about is like, is the nature is the nature of
the
group
essence of
what
group
else
chat.
About, you know, how much of what we talked about today, like how much of group chat does that cover? Do you know what I'm saying?
I think
you've convinced me that there are very economics facets of group chats.
Yeah.
And what I'm trying to determine is like how substantive are those facets in painting the concept
of
the
group
chat.
Okay. This seems like it's not going to go well for me.
I think I'm going to give like, I think I'm going to give a 7. I think group chats are 7 economics.
Okay, I'll take it.
Seven out of 10.
I'm not stoked, but as a starting point, I think I can work with a 7. I think I can try to get better from here.
I think in particular because, like, thinking about, I think I find what you said about, like, the optimal group chat size super compelling.
Yeah.
But then I don't think my group chats are even close
sized.
To the optimal size, which, you know, I don't know quite how to weigh that because it's like, well, do I rate them as they should be or do I rate them as they are? I don't know.
I did try to kind of hide that one in the middle. It's also just boils down to like marginal benefits and marginal costs. Like the analogy was not as strong as I thought it was at the beginning. But,
No, I liked it.
Yeah. So a 7. Pretty
okay.
good.
I'll take it.
Pretty
I'll
good.
Take it. Yeah.
And we got room to improve in the future.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. It would be. It'd be kind of a bummer if like first episode was a 10 and then just.
Yeah.
Worse
I
from
just.
There.
I don't want to establish ourselves as having like no credibility. We need room to go up and we need to have room to go down.
Yeah. Yeah. I did kind of. I'm not going to take back my 8.5, but I think that would be like very petty of me to just be like, oh, you did 7. So I did kind of panic, like, I don't know what numbers should be. But I think yours deserved it. There's a lot of interesting matching.
Thank you. Okay, should we wrap it up?
Yeah.
All right. See you later.
See ya.